Welcome to Smart Cherry's Thoughts. This is Sai from India.
Good to meet you, dude.
Nice to meet you, Kavir. Thank you very much for giving me opportunity to interview you for my YouTube channel and podcast and for my platforms.
It's a pleasure. I've gone through a few of your interviews already. Pretty cool. Cool people. Glad to be here.
So I have seen your profile. I can see you're doing a lot of work. So I thought to tell about the work that you're doing and also the service that you're providing to the humanity.
Yes.
To my audience.
Okay.
So can you please...
for me to start?
Yeah. Can you please introduce yourself?
Yeah. I'm Kavir Bihari. I'm the founder and CEO of Ubiquity AI, LLC. I manage a team of experts from around the world, and we've developed a world-first AI solution that seeks to address one of the biggest problems we have in the global economy today that affects households, and that's over-indebtedness. So whether you're in South Africa, whether you're in the US, and whether you're, you know, a millennial in India, over-indebtedness is a ubiquitous problem, right? The funny thing is that in the last 50 years, the way banks and lenders deal with it has never changed. So if I just put a broad, high-level perspective on the problem, when a person misses a payment, credit card, loan, whatever, you're usually given a 30 days to pay, and then you face some sort of internal collection, and then you face some sort of external collection. And that process, once it goes to external collection, globally, there's only about a 20% successful collection rate. I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, just think about it. From all the money that gets lost to default, only about 22, 25% is ever recovered, right? That's a terrible success metric. I mean, which other industry is as ineffective anywhere in the world? There isn't another industry that I can think of where 25% success accounts for a successful business model. It just doesn't. But let's just park the industry problem for now. I was more interested in the human problem. So I was the youngest economic journalist in South African history when I became a journalist in 2002. And at that stage, it was the new South Africa, the young South Africa, right? We became a democracy in 94. And there was all this talk about how do we become an inclusive economy? How do we get black South Africans into the mainstream economy? Because the architecture of apartheid was to keep black South Africans out of the formal economy, right? That was by policy design. That was apartheid. So after 94, we started as a country thinking quite seriously about how do we get broad-based black participation into the formal economy. And South African economy was great. I mean, we were one of the largest resource exporters. You know, we're highly skilled. Even today, we've got a highly skilled workforce, much like India. And we've got a lot going for us. But how do we broaden participation in the economy? So while everybody was talking about that, it quickly dawned on me as a young economic journalist that that actually wasn't the primary problem. There was a more fundamental problem, and that was financial inclusion. How do we get black South Africans, blacks, Indians, and as we call them, coloreds, you know, non-whites, let's call it non-whites. How do we get them into the formal financial sector? Because we were in many ways excluded from that as well by design. And when you drill down into the problems, the banks and our government, we focused on financial inclusion. So how do we get making a bank account easier? You know, in India, you've got the same problem. You don't even need a bank account in India. You just use UPI and, you know, you can use your phone as a bank, in essence. But I mean, this is where much of the focus was between then and now. How do we get more people into banking? But there's a fundamental problem with financial inclusion that nobody talks about. It's all good and well getting people into banking, but how do we keep people in banking when they become financially vulnerable? Because yeah, they'll give you a credit card, they'll give you a loan, they'll give you an overdraft facility, miss a payment and see what happens. They kick you to the curb, and then there's no more financial inclusion for you. And that's a problem. So financial inclusion has two sides to that coin, getting people in and keeping people in while they become financially vulnerable. So remember I spoke to you about debt collection a little bit earlier. That model is designed to exclude people. There's financial inclusion and financial wellness for you all the time, up until the point where you've got a problem and you now can't pay. And here's one of the interesting things. Every person would love to pay their accounts. Every person would love to pay their accounts. I just looked at an article by NerdWallet. It was a survey. 35% of people who miss payments say they forgot about the payment. About another third say that they had some sort of an emergency and they couldn't afford to pay. And then about another third say, well, I had essentials. I needed to buy essentials. And I mean, these surveys are done year after year after year after year. But that's not an actionable insight, right? I mean, if 35% of people are missing their card payments because they forgot, well, use nudge theory and remind them. It's simple. But I don't think that's the real reason. That's what people say. If you drill deeper into the research, people miss payments for four reasons. Change in family. Wife kicks husband out of the house, family's disrupted. Health problems, whether it's you, your mum, your wife, your kid, that has a financial strain on a broader family. Change in employment, you've been furloughed, you've been retrenched, your boss cuts your hours, you've been fired. That's another disruption, right? And then the fourth one is general over-indebtedness. And this is becoming a global theme. I mean, right now in the UK, one of the richest countries in the world, this winter, middle-class families that are richer than you and me in South Africa and India, because their middle class is a little bit richer and wealthier than our middle class, right? They're going to have to choose in certain evenings whether they have steak for dinner or whether they heat their houses because of the high cost of food and energy. And middle-class Brits are having to make these choices, not just those in India or poor countries anymore. So this is a problem that we see becoming it is already a universal problem, and there's never been a solution. So we think that we have established and developed a world-first solution to directly tackle this over-indebted problem, to reduce banks' impairment or credit losses, but more importantly, to help people when they need that help the most. When you get that news, your husband was in an accident and now you know you're going to be in financial trouble. When you've lost your job, where you've been funding your lifestyle and living expenses through credit cards. I mean, 40% of Americans that use Buy Now, Pay Later use it to buy food. I mean, isn't that astonishing? You're buying your food on Buy Now, Pay Later credit. If that doesn't tell you how desperate the household situation is, I don't know what does. So just to get back, I've looked at this problem for 20 years. And over 20 years developed this solution, which is a chatbot called Simone. And we are now piloting Simone with one of the world's 10 largest banks. And in doing so, we plan to fundamentally turn that debt management and debt collection model on its head. So I want to ask if you have any questions for me, because I'm quite happy to tell you how we're doing that. I mean, I'm always excited to talk about that. I'm always excited to talk about solutions that help people. I don't really care too much about companies. Companies always figure things out, right? But when you've got a company solution that puts customer first, that excites me. So yeah, I mean, I'm happy to go on, but if you've got any questions, I'm happy to take it.
So what kind of problems that you have solved after you getting this thought?
Right. So the problem is, like I told you in the NerdWallet research, right? Okay, so we know 35% of people forget to pay. We know that 22 or 32% can't pay their credit card because they've got to buy an essential. And we know that another third have got some sort of an emergency. That information is not actionable, right? The real question is, why do people miss payments? What are the real reasons people miss their card payments? And then when they miss their payments, why do they behave the way they behave? So when a person misses a payment and that account goes into default, they tend to avoid their creditors. They don't answer private numbers. They don't respond to messages. They don't respond to SMSs. They kind of tend to ignore the credit provider. I'm not saying in all cases. I'm saying in most cases. But why does a consumer behave like that? And we looked into those problems. And I can tell you what those problems are. When you miss a payment, the number one thing that you are avoiding in talking to your debt collector or your credit card issuer or your bank, you know they're going to ask you, hey, sir, you missed your payment. Are things going well? Blah, blah, blah. But all they really want to know is, how much can you pay and when can you pay by? So they want you to make a commitment, right, to that payment, to catching up, correct? I'm talking at a very granular level now, right? I mean, but to develop technologies, you need to understand problems at a very granular level. So we've taken, I think, 7 years to kind of understand these problems. And I mean, the research we've done is quite extraordinary, and we can go into that. I mean, it might be useful for founders to understand that having AI and looking for a ball to hit is not something that I would ever advise. If you're a domain expert that understands problems deeply, then you can go out and shop for a solution. So we didn't have AI, even though I'm very good at data analytics. I never went and said, right, I've got an AI solution. Let me find a problem. This is a problem that I understood really well, sought to find the underlying reasons, and we arrived at AI as the solution. So let me just tell you why people avoid the credit providers. One is stigma. If you lose your job, you feel ashamed, sort of embarrassed, right? You don't want to really face the world and tell them, I lost my job, I was fired, or whatever happened. And that leads to the second issue, psychological as well, is judgment. You're speaking to some idiot in a call center now, right, about why you missed your payment. His objective is to get you to pay. Your objective is to convince him that I don't think I'm going to be able to make that commitment. That's generally how a debt collection call works, right? So it's stigma and it's judgment. But the single most important one that we learned in our research is that people do not like to lie. Fundamentally, they do not like lying and they do not like making commitments they cannot keep. So when that call center dude is saying, sorry, can you pay 400 rupees by the 25th? And you say, ha, ha, ha. You don't know if you're going to have food tomorrow. You can't make that commitment for the 25th of the month, right? And people tend to avoid their creditors altogether. That's in addition to the fear, which is the last factor. Fear, and people don't really understand the options they've got available to them when they become financially vulnerable. So let me just repeat that, right? So that's stigma, judgment, fear, and the fear of lying, or the fear of being committed to something they know they can't commit to. Those are, at a psychological level, the reasons people, when they miss their payments, they tend to not manage the situation correctly. And what happens when they behave in that way? Your creditor says, well, Sai is not a person I can trust. We're not going to recover this. We're going to hand this over to a debt collector. You deal with the debt collectors now. People don't know this, but banks are not handled for collections. They outsource that. And this guy that works on commission, he's got zero empathy for you or zero understanding for the problems you face. All he wants is his money because he's got a contractual obligation to the bank, right? So he doesn't care about you. He doesn't care about what you're going through. And like I said, historically, all this entire process has only resulted in a 22% success rate. So we looked at So that's the problem. So the problem is, why do consumers become indebted and how can we help them avoid default? And the second problem is that because impairments are generally so high, especially in the emerging markets like India, South Africa, etc. In South Africa, your 90-day delinquency rate is 25%. It's astonishing. But what does that mean from a banking model? It means that banks make a provision for 25% impairment or credit loss. And what do? They price that into the interest rate that they charge every consumer. That's what they do. So if you want to ask me what's the problem is that impairments are high. They're priced into the product. It's like a healthcare risk provider. You need the fit young guys to subsidize the old guys that are becoming sick and getting heart attacks, right? That's how health insurance works. And it's kind of the same in credit lending. If your impairment rate is 25%, you'll make a provision for that, and everybody pays for that 25% impairment rate. So on the consumer, I've explained the problem, the psychological problem that leads consumers to make poor choices, avoiding their credit provider. And, you know, even if you lose your job, you may get a job next month, right? But when you blacklisted at the credit bureaus, you blacklisted for 5 years. So I don't want people that have a short-term problem to suffer long-term consequences, because once you're excluded for a long time from the financial services sector. That's on the consumer side. On the creditor side, they don't have an effective way to manage impairments. So they just pass the cost on to consumers, write you off, sell your debt, and you sit for 5 years struggling to fight with your credit bureaus, with the debt collector that bought your debt. It's a bit of a mess. What is the solution? It's such a simple, elegant solution. If we know why people miss payments, and I just explained to you the, you know, change in family, change in health, you know, we know what the main problems are. Why can't we speak to our customers throughout the month to understand if they are experiencing any category of these problems that makes them vulnerable to missing their payment at the end of the month? I mean, just think about that. It's simple, right? Simple idea. If we know that there's only four risks to you missing your payment, let's try and understand if you are becoming vulnerable before you default. Now, why is that important? Because if you are becoming vulnerable, financially fragile, instead of saying, your payment for 500 rupees is due, if I know that you're not going to be able to pay the 500 rupees, let me speak to you and maybe you can pay 10 rupees or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 rupees, right? Maybe you can afford that because we can look at your whole credit history and we can look at the kind of person you are and say, you've been a very good customer. Don't worry about the 500. Can we do the 50? But what does that do? That builds a foundation for engagement that prevents you from running away, because now the bank has said, okay, we understand your problem. How can we help you? Banks have known about this for a very long time. Firstly, if we can predict your intent, we can help shape your choices. But there has never been a scalable solution. But with AI and blockchain, it's now possible. So I can send out a message to 20 million customers simultaneously, ask everybody how they're doing, and through very clever psycholinguistic approach, determine whether you are becoming financially fragile or not. And if we are, through the same automated AI system, let's automate an alternate payment arrangement that discourages you from blocking us on your phone. Let's help you get through this little crisis, 10 rupees a month for the next 3 months. But you know what? You're not going to be blacklisted 6 years or 5 years from now. So that's how we're helping customers. And we're using AI and blockchain to my priority has always been a zero marginal cost solution. The way you scale up at zero marginal cost is obviously AI and obviously blockchain. So while companies have got these very sophisticated databases that are expensive, etc., we provide an end-to-end solution that's driven by blockchain to automate that alternate payment arrangement, and AI to engage with you over WhatsApp to find out how you're doing mentally so that we can identify if you need help before you miss a payment. So what are we in essence doing? We are predicting the problem before it occurs, and we are averting the problem altogether. So we're doing pre-delinquency collection in effect. So that's how we're changing banking.
So I have a combination of questions for the explanation that you gave. You have mentioned the countries and the financial systems, that how things work in the banking systems. I'm also a consumer. My state is one of the top states in India, financially, economically, highest, top second. And also India is top fifth country in economy recently.
I know very well.
The statistics says that India is not a poor country. So I want you to be very specific about what you are mentioning. Since you have said you have done the research about how banking system and how consumers of different banking systems and which society you have done the research, and what are those statistics told you that this is the problem that the consumers are facing, and which part of the world they belong to. So that since my platform is global, people from different countries will be watching this and listening to this. If you can be very specific about the research and the information that you have, that will be very clear where exactly, since it's a very broad subject and also very big area in land and also in population wise. So if you can be very specific about,
yes. I will. So as I've told you earlier, I'm from South Africa. South Africa is unique in that we've got one of the strongest banking systems in the world. And I'm talking not just from an industry technological point of view. South Africa's banks are always among the most globally innovative, or innovative globally. We've taken awards, on multiple occasions for innovation. So we have a very strong banking sector. We've got a highly regulated banking sector, but we've also got an emerging market society, not very sophisticated in banking. So to be successful in South Africa, you need to adhere to our very strong EU, UK, Canada level regulations, but apply it for an unsophisticated population. So it puts us in a very unique position because we're solving major, problems, applying global standards, banking standards, to a developing market population. So it puts us in a very unique position to look at global trends, look at vulnerable societies, and develop innovative solutions in banking, very much like what you do in India, right? So the research that we've conducted, we're an American company. The company that the bank we're doing the pilot with, and in fact, we arranged this pretty quickly, but I would need their approval to actually mention. It's quite a strategic project, as you can imagine. So it's a global bank that we've partnered with, one of the world's top 10 banks, and we are running the pilot in South Africa. But our target markets are primarily in the EU and the US. Now, just to talk about the statistics. In India, it's not a market that I look at closely, but our chief technology officer and our applied scientist are both from India, globally eminent experts. And we obviously have a lot of conversations about the issue, the issues in India as well. And what they've alerted me is the fact that, much like South Africans, the millennials in India are becoming increasingly over indebted for very much the same reason that Black South Africans are becoming over indebted. When you've been excluded from the formal economy and your kid is becoming the first kid ever to go to university, and that family is seeing upward economic mobility, what do you want to do? You want to buy that Mercedes Benz that your family has admired for 100 years and could never afford, right? You want to buy your first car. I mean, these are things that millions of families in India and millions of families in South Africa could never do, right? And now, over the last few years, we can do. So what are we doing? You're spending a lot on big houses. You're spending a lot on fancy clothes. You're spending a lot on cars because our parents could never afford to do it for us. So a lot of us in India, especially the millennials, are becoming over-leveraged, and it's the same problem in South Africa. So I understand that commonality. But when we drill into the quantifying the problem, America, for example, we know the stats, right? 7% of credit cards are in delinquency in America. It's the highest level in many, many, many years. In South Africa, we know that delinquencies are 25% across the board. In Canada, delinquency levels are actually higher than the US. You know, so quantifying the problem is important, but we know that this is a universal problem, and it's been a universal problem for quite some time. Now, you seem like you're a lot younger than me. Since 2009, the world has lived in a zero interest rate or benefits from a zero interest rate economy, right? Because interest rates have been near zero in America, in Europe. And now you're seeing a 20x increase in finance costs in America. So while the problem is big now, it's going to explode in a few years. Just an astonishing figure. That credit card delinquency is at 7% in the US, but Americans are paying over 20% in credit card interest rates. You know, so, and they've got the biggest credit card balances ever. So they are highly indebted and they are paying extraordinary interest rates on those credit facilities. And their income isn't changing. American salaries and wages are not getting, you know, high. It's a recipe for disaster. So it's not a matter of, you know, splitting hairs over the statistics. One can look at the macroeconomic picture and you know that higher inflation, higher interest rates, structurally higher interest rates is going to lead to an explosion in consumer credit defaults. That's the point. That's the big point here.
So we are talking specifically about a couple of countries. When we talk about global, if you can mention also statistics of more than 190 countries, it will be good.
No, so we don't look at 190 countries for the simple reason banking legislation is different around the world. So we focus on the countries where we understand banking legislation. For example, the United States, right? For example, the UK, the EU, South Africa. And I mean, those markets are monsters. I mean, just those, you're talking about 2.5 billion accounts in those markets. So, you know, for a startup, that is already a huge chunk in terms of market size for us. But just to tell you that whatever happens in the US is usually replicated. So can I just talk about the global picture? I mean, I can't remember statistics off the top of my head. I mean, we do know that credit balances in the US are at the highest level ever. We do know that consumers are paying over 20%. We do know that credit card impairments or delinquencies are at around 7%, which it's historically high. We do know in Europe that you're seeing an uptick. I haven't looked at the stats in the EU recently, but in the UK, it's all following the same American trajectory where credit card balances are exploding at higher interest rates. I don't remember the stats offhand. It's not something that we look at every week. Once you kind of understand the problem, I mean, you know, we look at it every 3, 6, 9 months. Is that something that's particularly important? What is important is to understand the macro landscape. What's the probability of an interest rate hike? What's inflation doing? Why is inflation doing what it's doing? So those are the things that we kind of look at. And so the statistics that you want are kind of meaningless to us at this point. But what I can tell you, what we are looking at is, we've seen inflation come down quite a bit this year, right, around the world, mostly in Europe, mostly in the United States. But even though most American pundits are saying inflation is going to be fine and things are going to be cool and, you know, we're going to have a soft landing, I don't think so. I think that last year, Europe had a very lucky break with energy prices because it was a warm winter. And Germany, for example, had their gas tanks full with Russian gas, right? That gas is finished. There's no Nord Stream. There's no supply. Germany does not have gas. They are importing LNG from the US at much higher prices, importing energy from India. And I think we're likely to see energy prices explode this winter, you know, European winter. And we're going to see inflation around the world once again rise to last year's levels. So when energy prices rise, food prices rise for somewhat similar reasons, who does it affect the most? It affects the middle class and the poor because they spend a disproportionately larger amount of their salary on food and transport. So from our point of view, that's the big picture. And those are the kind of things that we focus on, not how many people in each specific market is delinquent. I mean, it's kind of meaningless. The 25% collection or 22% collection rate alone justifies us solving this problem, right? That problem is not, you know, that statistic is not that important for us. What is important for us is understanding what is the global macroeconomic picture. India is doing remarkably well at the moment. It's not our target market, even though my core team is based in India. But we do see the Western economies really struggling over the next 12 months. So we are pushing this pilot as fast as possible. We need to validate the concept. It's a world first pilot. It's never before been done. Pre-delinquency collection has never before been done anywhere as far as we know of. So we need to validate the hypothesis and we need to roll out commercially, which we're planning to do by Q1 next year.
So who will get benefit with this? The banking system or the consumers?
First and foremost is the consumer, because when a consumer becomes financially fragile for the reasons I mentioned, often they feel they've got no solutions, right? Especially when they run out of money. They feel like they don't have solutions. So here we are, a banking app that is proactively offering you assistance when you are becoming financially vulnerable. So we're giving you a lifeline at a point where you really need the help. Remember, we are identifying financially fragile people and assisting them before they default. So number one would be the consumer. Because with AI, we can just, I mean, it's a highly scalable solution and it's very cheap. So number one is a consumer. Number two is that the reason you've got the 25% collection rate is quite simple. When a person has missed a payment, it's very difficult to collect after he's missed a payment. So what are we doing? We're starting the collection process before due date. And that's a fundamental shift in global banking. And that's why we went for that's why we targeted the world's top 10 banks. If you want to disrupt, I'm not going to go and disrupt the bank, global banking industry, you know, with a local bank. If I want to disrupt, I need to go to the global top 10 banks, because if one guy changes the process, the other nine are going to follow. That was our strategy. So both consumer first. For me, it's always consumer first. Bank second.
So if the due date is before the actual date of the bank is that not a burden on a consumer to pay?
No. I don't. So we've done testing, and that's actually not the case. If you can communicate in a way that's empathetic towards the consumer throughout the month and keep that engaging, the problem isn't a technology one. It's a human connection one. So if you can embed empathy and you add value to your consumer's life, for example, my chatbot contacts you on the third of the month. Hey, dude, these are the top happenings in India from an economic point of view. I thought you might find this interesting. Or, hey, dude, your payment of $10 is due at the end of the month. Let me know if you've got any problems and confirm that you'll be making payment, full payment on due date. And if not, let me know why and let me see if I can help you. Those are customer-centric, pro-consumer type of interventions. So I'm not going to tell you exactly how we do it. That's the proprietary secret sauce. But what I'm saying is it's about human connection. The AI is not the solution. The AI is just an enabler. Our solution is very much a human-to-human empathetic solution.
So being a founder of a company which actually works on AI, I'm sure you might have done a lot of work in your 20 years of career, maybe more, how human connections and human relationships and what are the like you have mentioned, four major problems which makes a human to fail to do the payment. So there are n number of problems which makes a human to pay on time. For example, the natural disaster called pandemic came and made a human to sit in the home for a long time without doing any work. Putting that apart, there are different human problems, which makes human to not to do the payment on time. And so in this, can I say you have done a lot of research in understanding, the 360 degrees of, human problems so that as a technology service provider, you are enabling the service by interconnecting AI and human both, and like you mentioned, empathetic AI need to have that empathy.
Well, it's not that AI needs to have the empathy, but AI can be used to convey empathy, number one. So I just wanted to touch very quickly about artificial intelligence, right? I don't care about AI. If I could partner with Banksy and Banksy could make me drawings and I could solve my problem, I'll use Banksy. AI is only a technology option. People become AI experts, and like I said, they're carrying this big bat, and then they start looking for balls to hit. You're missing the point of the potential of AI. Let me tell you where I see the benefit of AI. We have found that there are multiple problems that AI can solve where existing human-to-human business models have failed. Right? So I told you debt collection is one. There's an even bigger problem. If you look at the number of people, I'm not sure about the numbers in India, but I can tell you at a global level, and this I can talk about a global level. If you look at the number of people with metabolic disease, right? Lifestyle diseases. In the year 2000, there were 70 million people with type 2 diabetes. By 2050, there's going to be 150 million people. Right? And this is despite the fact that we are all becoming more health aware and conscious, even in India. And this is despite the fact that every government in the world is committing a larger percentage of their fiscal budget on healthcare. So if a government is spending more on healthcare, you would expect the number of incidences to fall. It'd be kind of like an inverse relationship, right? But how is it that we are spending more and more people are getting sick? That's not right. We understand this trend. We as societies are spending on healthcare to treat symptoms. We are not spending on healthcare to address the underlying causes. What is the underlying cause of metabolic syndrome, which is going to be the going to cause the explosion in healthcare costs? People's behavior, right? We see more people around the world, India included, where they go to health coaches and fitness coaches and mind hacking coaches and business coach and that coach, etc. But it's only the wealthy that can afford to do that, right? I mean, I don't know too many people that can afford a gym instructor 7 days, 5 days a week. It's bloody expensive. What is the opportunity of AI? We can democratize access to coaching and other information at zero marginal cost. That's what AI enables us to do. So if you're going to sell this Simone-type solution, my-type solution to a health insurance provider, and you say, okay, you incentivize all your members to get the app. And when they get the app, Simone will ask them a bunch of questions. Whether they answer or not doesn't really matter in the beginning, because they're going to get the picture eventually. Do your 10,000 steps or 7,000 steps. Eat regularly or do your whatever the healthcare, the health risk provider wants the guy to do. We can convey that to the customer at zero marginal cost. You know what I mean? What was the option before that? The option before that is we make calls or you do an annual health checkup, or every other option is very expensive and doesn't work. AI enables interactive two-way engagement that we can analyze using big data in real time. You know, I can give your healthcare provider your health picture every day. And I can tell him where your mind is. Ah, he's becoming more mindful about his eating. Ah, he's becoming like this. Or we can pick up those trends instantly over our chatbots. You know what I mean? And these are the type of models now that are super exciting for me. Because, I mean, so you've got healthcare. You've got education, right? You've got citizen engagement. Governments can do this. What are your thoughts on X, Y, Z? How is your community doing? When's the last time you spoke to your counselor? You know, these are things now that we can collect this data instantly from all 1 billion Indians and have a photographic image in real time, not based on some random survey that talks to 2,000 people, but we can now talk to every single citizen in real time and analyze that data. That's the power of AI. That's the potential of AI. AI is the enabler. But what problem are you solving, right? We want people to be financially secure. We want them to learn how to manage their money better. We want them to look after their health. We want to democratize access to education, and we want them to become better citizens. We want greater citizen participation. And these are areas in AI and engagement that I think are extraordinary opportunities for us. Extraordinary. I mean, these are the biggest problems we've got in the world today. There's no bigger problem than the problems I just spoke to you about now. Citizenry, education, health, and money. And AI can automate solutions for all of these at zero marginal cost. It's just been impossible to do these sort of things at scale in a way that makes cost sense. But with AI, we can.
So my question was, as a person who has a deep understanding about about the human's reality and the practicality. Are you only into banking system with the AI service that you're providing, or the AI tools or technology that you have, or you are into other industries as well?
Okay, so Ubiquity has got a team that spans the four corners of the globe: Singapore, India, France, South Africa, and we founded the team on domain expertise, meaning we didn't prioritize technology staff or technology partners. We prioritized getting in people that have a deep understanding of the problems that we are focused on. So I come from this financial services background, It's a problem I understand very, very well. So when I got a computational linguist and I got a mind hacking coach, we've got some interesting people in our team. We hired to look at very pragmatically and at a very granular level, how could AI help in this scenario? And then we went out and built our AI team. And I wanted to tell you, we went through multiple experts and multiple AI developers. And it took us quite some time, but today we have, I think, the best team in the world. I can't see there being a better team anywhere. I mean, our applied scientist, he's Indian. He's a kid. He's 21 years old. He's ranked 248 on Kaggle at the age of 21. It's extraordinary for a data scientist, you know. Our CTO, I mean, she's globally eminent, you know. So, and how are we able to attract these incredible skills? I think that when you're a company that understands its purpose and its vision really well, it's easy to attract people that have a similar vision and purpose. And because we invested heavily in industry experts, I think we're able to articulate our vision and our purpose really, really, really well. So when we're hiring tech people or we have, you know, partnering with tech partners, these guys love working with us because they understand what we're doing and they align with it. So to answer your question, we're a startup. Our domain experts in the team are both strong in financial services, and we've got a team of healthcare experts as well for both the problems I spoke to you about, right? Health promotion and managing money. But as a startup, it's very difficult to convince investors that you're a startup that can do both. They won't believe. So we've positioned ourselves exclusively on the financial services side. We were very lucky to land one of the 10 largest banks in the world. And I mean, once this pilot is done, I mean, obviously we've got all the credibility in the world. We'll never have to convince another soul, right? That bank will just go, will leverage the hell out of this project. And that enables us to actually then focus on our healthcare, which is one of my passions. I'm diabetic and I'm educated. And I cannot tell you how difficult it is for me to stay on track day after day. I mean, I'm an educated guy. I know what I need to do, right? But it's difficult, man. It's difficult. It's difficult. It's really tough. It's tough if you're living with any kind of disease like diabetes. I mean, I just heard the other day, one of my best friends who died recently, he was overweight, his younger brother died of type 2 diabetes at the age of 40. This is not right. It should not be happening, you know, today with all our technological advances. It was his disease management regime that led to his death. So his leg got amputated and he was like dead. I mean, we can avoid these things. We can prevent these things. And we can do it very cheaply.
So how many projects you have done till now?
Right. So the banking project that we've done, that we're doing, this project has taken us 6 years to get to the stage that it is right now. One project. So the chatbot part is simple. I mean, you know, I could give you $100 to build me a chatbot today. And if you never saw a chatbot, you'd go on YouTube and you'd build me a chatbot today. People can do that. But we're building an extraordinary chatbot, right? I don't think it's something that one could build. And the intellectual property that is embedded in the chatbot took since 2017 to acquire. So a lot of the psychological inputs, etc., that we've spoken about are not just, you can't just go and ask Perplexity AI or Google, why do people miss payments? That kind of research is not out there, believe it or not. It's funny. Go and look for it. It's taken us quite some time to actually get into the mind. We've conducted our own ad hoc research, just walking on the streets, speaking to people. 100% of people we've spoken to said that if they got into trouble, they would love a solution like this, where they could just tell a bot, I've got a problem, and not have to deal with another person again. 100%. So, you know, it's a thing I ask every person I meet, and I may have asked over 2,000 people. All 2,000 people said, if I never have to speak to a human when I'm going through something, I'll do it. I'll take it. And what makes this project so cool is that it happens over WhatsApp. So WhatsApp doesn't allow debt collection or anything like that. We're not doing debt collection. We are identifying fragile consumers and helping them, giving them the tools to avoid being kicked out of the system. And I think we're the first project of its kind in the world that was given approval by Meta for this use case. So there isn't another project similar on Meta's entire platform, WhatsApp, Facebook, whatever. We're the first. So I know we're onto something good.
And you're trying to make things easier with the artificial intelligence to the intelligence.
Yes. Yes. So the work that we were doing, it's so funny. So we were spending so much of time, effort, resources on machine learning, and then whoop, there comes OpenAI, right? OpenAI. And a lot of the work and a lot of the money that we wasted, we can simply now just lower our AI costs dramatically by just using OpenAI. And natural language processing has evolved so significantly since 2017. So I launched the first NLP, natural language processing data analytics company in the Middle East and Africa. So I can really torture and analyze words. That's my skill. I'm not an AI expert. But once I understood NLP, it was pretty easy to kind of understand NLP and AI. I mean, it's almost the same thing, right? So we were using NLP for big data social analytics 10 years ago. But I mean, the underlying technology is the same for chatbots, the NLP technology. But it has improved and evolved to such an extent. It's astonishing. And I think that you combine that with many low-code solutions. And I mean, if you're a dude in your house that's committed to some problem, teaching people how to, I don't know, do a proper push-up or bench press, etc., I mean, you could develop a chatbot by yourself, you know, to meet a problem that you don't think is being adequately solved. And it's just become so much easier to embed AI to solve real problems, and anybody can do it. You don't need to develop or rely on, you know, developers and CTOs, you know, from all over the world. You can do it yourself. It's pretty simple and straightforward now. So AI is democratizing access to technology solutions to anybody that is passionate about solving practically any problem. And that's what I love about AI. The tools are becoming so much easier to use. So much easier. It's wonderful.
So at last, to the normal audience who are not into technology, what do you say to them at the same time, to the technology experts, also to the business leaders, founders, CEOs who are working on different products and services from anywhere on this planet? What message that you want to give and what you want to tell to them through this platform?
I've got an interesting perspective being an economic journalist. Well, having started my career as an economic journalist, you are trained to think as an economist at a top level to see the big picture. And the one thing that I have noticed over the past few months and years that not many people are talking about, or people are talking about in a very incorrect sort of way, is that technology is becoming so cheap, it's going to enable countries like India, South Africa, Nigeria, developing countries in Eastern Europe, to simply bypass developed nations in solving big problems like healthcare, like banking. I mean, I think India is the best example in the world of how technology democratized access to financial services, right? I don't need to go there. And 15 years before that, you had African countries that had no telephone infrastructure, and they said, well, forget it, we're going to just go straight to cellular. And they said, well, we have no banks. And they said, well, let's just use our phone as banks. And Africa has led the way in mobile banking. But you've seen such an explosion of wonderful technologies today that many of the problems that our forefathers have struggled with, you don't need to be a technology proficient genius to exploit technology. I think the more valuable person today is that domain expert that understands his business really, really, really well. I mean, if I went to a VC and I told the VC I spent 5 years trying to understand my debt default problem, he's going to tell me, you're bloody crazy. What kind of idiot, you know, it's speed, you know, money. No, I'm sorry. But if you're a VC and things like that, you're not the company for me. Understand the problem. Even as an industry expert, it took me 5 years to get into the mind of a financially fragile human being. Understand whether you're a business owner, an executive, whether you're a tech person, whether you're a layman. Understand at a granular level the problems that resonate with you, the problems you are trying to solve, and then go and look at what are the potential solutions. I told you, and this is honest, if I could partner with artists like Banksy and develop cool Instagram posts that incentivize people to contact their credit providers and not run away from them, I would do that. It's so much easier. I wouldn't have to put up with tech bros, you know what I mean? We just arrived at AI. AI wasn't something we said, sounds cool, let's go find a problem to solve. And I see a lot of people doing that. I see a lot of companies that have fear of missing out. I see a lot of developers. I see a lot of VCs. I mean, so it was Web 3.0, and then it was NFTs, and then it was this, and then it was that. And after ChatGPT, it's now NLP. Don't go chasing hypes. Become committed to the problems you are solving and try and understand them first. So we're going to take our time. But by the time this reaches a customer, our pilot is going live this month. So the time has come now. But I mean, we've taken Simone, our bot, to market at a time where we are 100% convinced that there's 100% probability of success. It's taken 2017, 6 years to deploy a simple chatbot.
So awesome. So I wish you solve problems for different industries as well. You have entered into medicine and also you are already into banking. I wish you reach everywhere in the world, and I hope your knowledge and the problem solving ability that you have or the observation that you have from the ground level, the information that you have collected, definitely it reaches many places in the world and more humans from different who are providing different services and who are creating different products need to utilize the service that you're providing and get benefit out of it and help more humans on the planet.
Thank you so much. I just want to make one comment for startups, because hopefully startups listen to this, right? I'm not a startup bro. I came from a very lucrative consulting industry, you know, to start a startup. And people normally start startups not because they want to make millions, but they see a problem that they don't see being addressed. They become deeply committed to the problem and they say, well, forget it, I'm going to do it myself. And that's kind of that was my how I ended up being a tech startup bro. But anyway, this is the advice I wanted to give, what I wanted to say. So with our business model, we started with the pure intention of helping the consumer, right? But then we said, if we're helping financially vulnerable consumers, we can't charge them a fee for that. We took quite some time to develop a business model where we can charge the bank for our services, but provide the service for free to consumers. And we were very clever. So we're telling banks, give us money to help your customers and we'll reduce your risk. And it's the same with healthcare, right? So we want to give consumers free advice for healthcare or tools to manage their healthcare, but we don't want to charge them because then they're not going to want to do it. So you want to give it to them for free, but then the guy who benefits is the risk provider, the health insurance company. So we are developing a value proposition for him that enables us to get payment and provide the service for free to the consumer. And it's a wonderful business model that I don't see too many examples of this. So I don't know, you know, there are millions of industries out there, but I mean, start thinking about how you can serve people by getting your revenue from somewhere else. So we found two clever examples of how to do that. And I would, you know, kind of urge entrepreneurs to start thinking along those lines, especially those problems, you know, that affect poorer parts of our society and our community. How can we add value to them for free, but in a way that makes commercial sense for companies to become involved? So yeah, I just wanted you to end up on that note, because I'm very committed to, I don't know, to identifying more opportunities like this.
So one last question, how you are able to enable the great communication system between AI and I?
Between AI and?
I, intelligence. Just
oh. All right. So we have invested heavily in computational linguistic capabilities. We have a very, very strong team, a super strong team. But that was significantly enhanced through access with OpenAI or partnering with OpenAI. That, you know, people may say a lot of things about OpenAI and ChatGPT. I mean, I don't really care about what it tells you. What I really do care about is its ability to understand you. That in itself is a great technological feat. So over the next few months, as the pilot goes live and as we commercialize and scale, this is going to be the busiest 6 months of our lives, because we will understand for the very first time how consumers interact on the platform. And through a combination of machine learning strategies and techniques, the idea is to scale up Simone's capability and NLU and responses. And that will improve at a geometric rate over the next 6 months. So by the time we become fully commercial, we would have acquired enough data from the pilot to really polish up the chatbot while this, you know, before it goes commercially live. But it's not an easy thing to do. And the solution is not with, I mean, you can get mechatronic engineers and AI engineers and all these tech geeks. The reason that not many companies have successfully deployed chatbots is because it is ultimately a communication linguistics problem. It's not an AI problem. So we've invested heavily on the computational linguistic capacity within the company to enhance and maximize the engagement. Because if your customer hates the chatbot, they're never going to use the bloody thing. You know, they're going to use it and they're not going to bother. You've always got to put that customer front and center of any AI application. And in fact, we've had to get rid of people because we've also had experts that only see things the way chatbot developers develop. We're not like those guys. We don't care about their principles. We care about your experience and our propensity to influence you. And we're only going to influence you if you trust us, if we are reliable to you, you know, if we add value and meaning to you. And I mean, these are much more complex than just technology questions. So, yeah, so we're addressing that AI question mark in a very non-AI kind of way.
So as an expert, as a business owner, as a solution provider, as a problem solver, what is your observation about my work?
Oh, so I listened to quite a few interviews last night after we chatted. I was very impressed by the breadth of experts that you're able to get onto your podcast with multiple subject, subjects and subject matter. So I suppose it's not easy for you because you can't sound like a dumbass, you know, if you're going to be talking about 10 million different things, but you somehow or the other manage to be relevant in all of them. And I found it to be enjoyable. And I like your long form, but I really enjoy the short ones as well. And I mean, you know, on YouTube, for example, you can talk about, well, why do people miss payments? I can tell you now, if you go on YouTube, you're not going to find an answer. So if you kind of like edit it to short forms, like quick punchy Q&As, you know, or, you know, deep insights in 30 seconds, that kind of thing, I think you're going to explode your channel. I love the experts you get on. I love your eye for the people you attract to the show. And I think you've got your fingers on the pulse of what the big issues of the day actually are. So yeah, I was very happy to be on board. I told you I'm extremely busy today. But I mean, this is something that I love talking about what we're doing. And I knew it was going to be a good interview, you know, based on what I saw yesterday. So yeah, dude, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. And I hope it added some kind of value to your listeners. So
it added a lot of value, actually. So I actually did a master's in software engineering and also bachelor's in computer science and engineering. Right now I'm doing some DevOps engineering projects and also being a software developer for a UK company remotely working from India. And also I have created this global communication system and experts like you from different parts of the world solving different problems and being in different parts of the world having completely different experiences. Not just technologists, I also interviewed, like you mentioned, psychologists, doctors, police officers who are totally from different domains, trying to understand how they are trying to solve problems in general. Not necessarily what technology problems. I just want to understand how they're solving the general problems in their professions. So doing this, that is my full-time job, actually, being a DevOps engineer. How this interacting with global experts, more than 100 countries experts I have interviewed in the last 200.
It's unbelievable. I'm so proud of you, and I don't mean that in a condescending way. It's not easy doing what you're doing, but you're doing an extraordinary job. I mean, it's so impressive, really.
So can you share your web links with my podcast listeners so that they can see the service that you're doing?
Oh yes, of course. I'll pop you a note when we get off. Right.
Can you spell it with your mom?
Oh, ubiquity.
Yeah, can you spell it?
UBIQUITY -AI.com. Our website is ubiquityai.com. On Twitter, you'll find me on at ubiquityai. And if you look at my profile, there's a link with every single contact option, LinkedIn, Twitter, website, the works. I'm very, very easy to get a hold of, as you know. And I just wanted to end off, give me the last word by saying, I do not meet too many youngsters, Gen Z or whatever you guys call yourselves now, I can't keep track, that really impress me. So I see guys that are really good at what they do, DevOps, so on and so forth. But to find youngsters that take deep interest in the world and have a deep passion for the world, guys like you, I think you guys are really special. I think you're really special. And you told me something interesting now, that you're quite interested in understanding how people from all over society solve problems. And I can actually, in my perspective, I've also solved massive problems. I mean, help change legislation, etc. And it kind of comes down to just three words, honestly. It's love, it's empathy, and it's transparency. If that is central to everything you're doing, it's unbelievable how easy it is to attract people to your cause. Seriously, that's, I think, one of my superpowers. I'm not good at tech. I'm not a tech person. I'm not a DevOps guy. I've never done computer science. I've done economics. But my propensity to attract experts is legendary. And my secret sauce is so easy. I just gave it to you.
I think you are using those qualities as the tools of the service that you're providing.
Absolutely. And, you know, sorry. I know we can carry on talking the whole day. But somebody asked me, like, with AI, what is your competitive advantage? So what are you doing that nobody else does? And when I speak to, like, VCs and that, they always ask this. And honestly, our answer is so simple. When a company develops an AI model, right, especially a commercial AI model, and you would understand this with your knowledge, they will develop this model around a company problem. So it'll be to tighten a process or to simplify a process or to automate this or et cetera. And through machine learning, the model becomes better and more and more and more and more efficient, right? I mean, that's the whole point of AI. However, at Ubiquity, we are very different. When we look at the problem, we looked at it from the consumer point of view. That financially distressed, that guy who was just divorced, this person whose mom just died in an accident. So when we developed our AI model, our language model, we didn't develop it around the company issues. We developed it around what are human beings going through. And we developed this AI model around that. So with every conversation and every exception that we have, and with every ML iteration, what is our model doing? It's becoming more and more and more biased towards who? The customer, right? Not the company process, which all our competitors, I mean, even the chatbot developers, it's always about us, we, etc., right? It's never about the consumer on the other side. And that's another thing that makes us really special, is that this is so biased towards the consumer. You know, it's not biased towards company process at all. It's biased towards consumer need. So, yeah, what was the other learning? Think about the person in front of you whose problem you're trying to solve. You can't solve their problems by developing a solution around us. It kind of doesn't make sense to me. And I think in years to come, when AI models evolve, how do you want your model to evolve? This way or this way?
This way.
Where we're completely insular, or where we are completely extrovert and cognizant of the people that we are serving. And these are material things in machine learning. I never see anybody in ML talk about this issue. They never talk about it. They talk about the ML strategies, etc. They never talk about what is the big strategy here. Oh, we're just shortening this process or automating that. Who cares? Is that the real problem? Maybe it is. You know, maybe it is. But if I'm looking at AI solving big problems, you need to kind of focus on this side of the table. Sorry, I could literally go on forever, but a very important view that we talk about quite regularly within the company as well.
And I totally agree with your observation and the way you look at things. And can I put this video on my YouTube channel with your permission?
Of course. Yeah, you got it. Just edit the, just do a decent job editing it. I am a bit irreverent now and then in my responses.
Sure. And also, can I put this audio and video clip on my podcast website, internet, social media, everywhere with your permission?
Yeah, of course. As long as you get the spelling of my name right and the spelling of Ubiquity AI, we cool.
I'll put exactly how it is.
No, I'm being facetious. Of course you can. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you very much again for your time and for the service that you're providing and helping a lot of humans to understand what they are going through.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. And, you know, just always keep flying the flag for those that are less fortunate and those that are in more trouble and those that are in greater need than us. Fly the flag back for them, especially in this podcast. All right?
Definitely. Thank
especially
you.
Especially your podcast. Thanks. Thanks, dude. Take care.
Thanks, sir. Again, take care. Bye.
Bye.